Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. For the entire month of January, Your Call is dedicated to focusing on solutions. We're kicking off the first Media Roundtable of the year by talking about solutions journalism, which provides rigorous reporting on responses to social problems. The goal is to help people understand problems and challenges, explain how we got here, and then show potential ways to respond. On today's Media Roundtable, we will discuss solutions journalism. We'll also talk about coverage of the most diverse Congress in history and what that actually means. We'll talk about the government shutdown and immigration. Joining us are two guests who practice solutions-based journalism. Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield is associate editor at Yes Magazine, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Yes inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. Zenobia covers racial justice, and she joins us on the line from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Zenobia. It's great to have you. I love Yes Magazine.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage on Native American and Indigenous communities. Antonia Gonzalez is a citizen of the Navajo Nation. She grew up in Arizona and New Mexico. And she joins us on the line from New Mexico. Hi, Antonia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, and Happy New Year to both of you. Well, as we always do on our Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So, Zenobia, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, of course, the swearing in of the most diverse Congress. I mean, I know we were going to start off with solutions journalism, but I think that was the highlight of the week. Yesterday was seeing the diversity. For me, it kind of uplifted my spirits about where things are, where things can go and hopefully will go. I think I saw a report where it was like 30 years ago, there were only 15 women Democrats who were in office. And now there's like 89, almost 90 women. I mean, and the number is still low, but it's a far cry from where we were before. That number still lower on the conservative side, but just the diversity that we have now was just hopeful for me.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in just a couple minutes because it's getting so much attention. But I'd like to go a bit deeper to talk about what the diversity actually means and why it's so important. What about you, Antonia? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, for Indian Country, it was a historic day on Thursday as the first two Native American women were sworn in to Congress, Representative Deb Haaland from New Mexico and Representative Sharice Davids from Kansas. They joined some male Native Americans who are in Congress, Representative Mullen and Representative Cole. So it was a historic day for people across Indian Country. You know, there was a honoring reception last night in Washington, D.C. for the two women. And not only just people who traveled from their tribal communities to go to D.C. and take part in this historic moment, but also Indian Country across the country. I mean, you were seeing social media posts blow up all day long with just people with the excitement and to see what these two women are going to do, not only for tribal nations, but the rest of the United States as well. And so I think that's definitely the biggest news story that we saw this week that was in a positive, good way.
Yeah, I mean, it really was amazing to watch. So Deb Haaland, a Democrat from New Mexico, is a member of the Laguna Pueblo. She's an attorney and once served as her state's Democratic Party chair. Sharice Davids, a Democrat from Kansas, is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She's also an attorney, a former mixed martial arts fighter, and the first openly LGBTQ member of Congress from her state. Can you talk a little bit, Antonia, about how this is being covered in Indian Country, specifically Indian media?
Yeah, so for tribal media, for sure, outlets have been covering this. You saw Indian Country Today, which is now based in Washington, D.C., at the NCAI headquarters, covering this all day and speaking with people. They went to both you know, the open houses for both of the congresswomen, and also just talking to people. We spoke with a woman this morning that was on our news who traveled from New Mexico, from Giwa Pueblo, which is near Albuquerque, and her family are voting advocates. So she traveled with her parents there, and she watched the swearing-in ceremony with her parents and also Deb Holland's family from the congressional office, and just talking about what a proud moment it was for her to be a Pueblo woman, and also just for the Native community. And she also talked about the importance of voting, and that her family, that this goes to show that a lot of the outreach and the importance of voting, and that she hopes it continues among the younger generations as well, and also just for the younger people to see these two women, these two Native women now who are in Congress.
And while it is incredible, you also have to remind yourself that it is 2019, and it's taken this long to have two Native American women in Congress. I'm also guessing that a lot of Native Americans, I mean, I've met a few Native Americans who said, yeah, I've been asked to run for office, but I'm not sure about taking part in the system that has historically done so much damage to our people. And that's the thing that I also wanted to really focus on here is, you know, the national media are talking about the firsts and how diverse this is, which of course is so incredibly important. But I'd like to go deeper with both of you. Antonia, I mean, really, I've been to Washington, D.C. If you just walk around without going to the Native Museum, there is hardly any reminder of how this country was actually founded. There are hardly any plaques. There's no statues. There's no wayside exhibits. If you go to the Native Museum, you can see some of that, but there's hardly anything. And it's not just D.C. It's really also across the country. So I just think it's so significant. And I'm wondering if these two women, I mean, obviously, they can only do so much. And when there's the first, the expectations are really high. But what are your thoughts about that? I mean, can we just go deeper about what this really means when you really look at the history of this country?
So we've heard from both of the women talking about now that they're in this role about educating members of Congress, and not to say that it hasn't been done. There are tribal leaders across the country. There are advocates across the country. There are Native organizations across the country who work year-round educating members of Congress, advocating for Indian country issues. But also now these two women are also up there saying that they're going to talk about the history of Native Americans and also the modern-day challenges and a lot of the different issues facing Indian country. So it really puts it there in not only the tribal media and public media that's been following them for a long time, but now also in the mainstream media, and just having these mainstream news organizations posing these questions. Sharice Davis was on national television yesterday and pointed out that you know, now that the two Native women are in Congress and that Native voices are there, that their job is not only educating members of Congress but also the public. And so you could really see that there are a lot of challenges, but there are also a lot of good things happening in Indian country. And both women mentioned that yesterday during their honoring ceremony, that there's a lot of work to do, yes, but there's also already a lot of good things to build upon in Indian country. And Deb Holland had made the comment yesterday that, you know, there, like I had mentioned, the tribal leaders, advocates, people in Indian country, grassroots groups have long been working on Indian country issues, and this lifts up a level beyond that, because there have been a lot of people working on committees and in different ways to get their issues out there, and just adding these women to the other members who are Native American in Congress just elevates that.
Antonio Gonzalez is anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage on Native American and Indigenous communities. And Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield is associate editor at Yes Magazine. Zenobia, what are your thoughts about how the diversity of this Congress is being covered? Here's a lead from Vox. On Democrat side of the aisle, a historically diverse class of women and people of color were clad in bright outfits as they were sworn in, while on the Republican side, a relatively homogenous group of mostly white men wore nearly identical dark suits. So it's important to point out the numbers and how, you know, we're doing better, but obviously there's a long ways to go. But what are your thoughts about the diversity and how that's being covered in the media? And how would you go deeper?
I think the important thing would be to really look at diversity in terms of the ideas and the policies that the new Congress people will bring to office instead of what they look like. I mean, what they look like is important. It is important that we have a Congress that reflects the country in which we live. But, you know, people can look differently and still hold the same views. And I think the important thing about these women who were sworn in and the people of color who were sworn in is that they're not just bringing diversity in their appearance, but diversity in their ideas, diversity in the policies that they are looking to put forward. When you asked about what was exciting, it was exciting to see all the women who were coming in, particularly for me, the women of color. It was also exciting to see, you know, Representative Maxine Waters, who will be chair of the House Finance Commission, and the plans that she has to undo some of the damage that Mulvaney did. And so I think that, yes, it's important to say, okay, look, we have a more diverse Congress that is that appears to be more representative of the country in which we live today. But the more important thing is to start to pull back and uncover all of those the ideas that they have that they're coming with, mm-hmm. not just what they look like and what they're wearing and, you know, those kind of things.
Right. And Maxine Waters will be the first black woman and the first woman to hold that position.
The first woman, right. Yes, and the first African-American.
Right. Yes. The new chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Well, since you're talking, and it's so important, since you're talking about Zenobia, about where people stand, so Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the first Palestinian ever elected to Congress, she's already making news. Last night at a move-on event, she said, we're going to go in there and impeach the mother bleep.
Yeah.
So that's and she wrote an op-ed about impeaching Trump. And then you've got 29-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the youngest member of Congress. She's making news for telling 60 Minutes that people who make extremely high salaries should be taxed at 60 or 70%. You know, Anderson Cooper, of course, they always ask when you're talking about the environment or college or healthcare, how are you going to pay for it? Which they should, but they don't ask that when you talk about military spending. So, of course, Anderson Cooper was shocked at this, but he failed to mention that the top marginal rate in 1960 was 91%. So a lot of these people are already coming out of the gate swinging, and these are not the Democrats of yesterday. I mean, if you look at their tweet, the way that they tweet, it's very, very different.
Yeah, they're very bold and fierce, and that's kind of what we need right now. I mean, especially when it seems as if all of us are going against a bully president, you know, if you will. You know, someone who's saying, nothing's going to happen until I get the money for my wall. You know, so we need people like them to you know, to stand up for us, and that's what they're doing. And I think the majority of American people appreciate that fierceness and that boldness that they're coming with.
What would you add, Antonia?
I think that it's going to be really interesting to watch and see. There are a lot of, you know, it's the guest that we had on our newscast this morning was talking about also just the weight of all of these issues and that the power that these people can have to make change, and that there are a lot of issues, but that they have hope. And as indigenous communities across the country are resilient, we've been through it. And so I think that having these new voices to Congress and allies, you'll hear tribal leaders and advocates and people working on these issues every day talking about you need all sides of the aisle, that it can't get done just with one side. So it'll be interesting to watch and see how these new voices add to the new Congress.
Antonia Gonzalez is anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage on Native American and Indigenous communities. Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield is associate editor at Yes Magazine, a nonprofit independent publisher of Solutions Journalism. Later in the show, we will talk about Solutions Journalism, but we wanted to kick it off by talking about Congress. We're going to talk about the government shutdown and immigration. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about coverage of the most diverse Congress in history? And it is so important to talk about where these new members actually stand on issues and what they're planning to do. If you have any comments on the government shutdown, and then later in the show, we'll talk about solutions-oriented journalism. For the entire month of July, Your Call is dedicated to focusing on solutions. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Well, House Democrats approved a plan yesterday to reopen the government without funding for Trump's border wall. We'll talk about that wall in a minute. But first off, let's talk about how this government shutdown is affecting more than 800,000 people across the United States. I think the media has done a pretty good job of letting the public know, and I'm thinking that a lot of people did not realize this. NPR reports that about 1 in 8 U.S. government workers are at the GS-6 level or below, meaning they earn just a little more than $40,000 a year, and probably less, even if their work is professional. And there have been a lot of articles about how people cannot pay their basics. Paul Kiefer, a furloughed federal employee, told NPR, quote, "Right now I'm worried about whether or not I can make my credit card payment, whether I can pay for the electricity, get any food, pay the rent, whether or not I'm going to be thrown out onto the street. It is that serious." Zenobia, what are your thoughts about media coverage of people who are struggling to pay their bills because of this shutdown?
Yeah, I will say that the stories that I've seen that are focusing on the workers, and I do appreciate that, the impact that it's having on them, not just, you know, that this is what's happening, but how they are struggling and how they will continue to struggle. It's not just what's happening now. And so the coverage that I've seen on that, I have appreciated the fact that they are actually, especially on television, you know, talking to people, where you see these mothers and you see veterans even, and how they're being impacted by what's happening. And so I will say that I do have an appreciation of the way that coverage has been showing how negatively this is impacting these families who are living basically check to check.
The Guardian had a piece called "Our Income Has Stopped. Shutdown Leaves Workers Stressed and Struggling." The Office of Personnel Management, the agency overseeing federal workers, sent out sample letters last week, along with suggestions for employees to negotiate lower rents during the furlough. In Detroit, Colleen Reagan, 31, a federal law enforcement agency employee, is living alone in a friend's basement as she waits out the end of the shutdown. With very little savings after moving for her job from Chicago, she's making do with the last paycheck she received. Antonia, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering the shutdown and specifically focusing on people who struggle to make ends meet?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of impacts for Native people, immediate and long term. I think a lot of tribal leaders that we've talked to are concerned about the long-term impacts. There definitely are a lot of Native people who work for the federal government, not only in Washington, D.C., but across the country. And their negotiations are stalled right now. There's a lot of concern about health care. Health, of course, law enforcement, health care are services that are continuing through the shutdown, but there's concern about, you know, longer-term impacts to that. There's food programs, a food program that a lot of Native people take part in. That's an area they're worried about because of staffing cuts. Also, violence against women, the Violence Against Women Act expired in December. So there are a lot of concerns about what the long-term impacts are going to look like for people in Indian country. Tribes are often, you know, hardest hit when it comes to these shutdowns, and especially when it comes to negotiations and contracts and looking at the longer term impacts that are going to impact Indian country.
Antonia, did you happen to see the New York Times piece about this called "Shutdown Leaves Food, Medicine, and Pay in Doubt in Indian Country"? It was written by two reporters, but a number of other reporters were on the ground in Michigan and in Denver, And it's a pretty in-depth piece. I'll just read the lead. For one tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, the government shutdown comes with a price tag, about $100,000 every day of federal money that does not arrive to keep health clinics staffed, food pantry shelves full, and employees paid.
Yeah, a lot of tribes rely on these contract services, and they're unable to provide a majority of funds to tribes, including in urban programs. The Navajo Nation is the largest reservation in the United States. There's a lot of dirt roads, actually in rural areas across the country, but definitely on the Navajo Nation, where the shutdown impacts them with, you know, road services, stuff like that. So there definitely are some hardships during these times, and tribal leaders, Native organizations, you know, need to check in with the federal agencies and see what kind of services can continue during the partial shutdown. So there definitely are those immediate impacts as well.
You mentioned food, and this Times piece says that if the shutdown continues, it could also curtail a Department of Agriculture food program that helped feed about 90,000 Native American people in fiscal year 2017. It's funded through January, but no new federal money will be designated if the government closing goes beyond that.
Yeah, there's definitely some concern about the SNAP program. And even for, you know, the people, the young people, elderly, and so there is a huge concern about how the partial shutdown are, you know, is going to impact these types of programs that a lot of Native people rely on.
Well, let's hear from a caller before we go to break. Let's go to Patty in San Francisco. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I had heard about the union that covers the federal employees to take the government to court, but then I didn't hear anything else about it.
Yeah, I was just looking this up. So I'm reading right now from Government Executive. Let me see if I can get into this. The nation's largest federal employee union on Monday filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over employees being forced to work without pay during the partial government shutdown that began last month. It's the American Federation of Government Employees, and a law firm in D.C. filed class action litigation in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims on behalf of all essential federal workers. So, yes, a lawsuit has been filed. Are you still there, Patty?
Yes, I'm still here. I've heard no reaction either from the White House or from the Congress.
Let's see. I don't see any reaction in this story. I'm guessing it was because yesterday, with the new Congress being sworn in, most in the media were focused on that. But we'll try to get an update, and we'll bring you some information. The lawsuit has been filed, and right now, I mean, it looks like it's basically Trump versus the Democrats. And, you know, we're going to talk about this wall. And it's interesting because for a while it seemed like the Republicans were really framing the debate. And then Nancy Pelosi last night said there is not going to be a wall. And I also, after the break, want to talk about a piece of information that's not getting much coverage. And that is that the United States already spends billions of dollars on militarizing the border. So that deserves a lot more attention. Thank you for calling in, Patty.
Yeah, what I was thinking is maybe that the lawsuit might actually break the deadlock between the two entities.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll find some more information by next week, but we'll also look during the rest of the hour. Thank you for calling. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're joined by Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield, Associate Editor at Yes Magazine. It's 2019. It's really a great time to subscribe to independent media, and Yes Magazine is a great magazine. They are dedicated to building a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. Find out more at yourcallradio.org. Antonia Gonzalez is anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage on Native American and Indigenous communities. And Antonia, what is the best way for people to watch your show?
We are carried on tribal and public radio stations across the country at 11 o'clock Mountain Time. And we're also have several other ways online at nativenews.net, and then, of course, different podcasts that people can subscribe to.
Okay, great. Thank you. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. Mark in Sonoma couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to ask you if you could talk about the law passed that affected Native voters in North Dakota that got a lot of attention right before the election. What's the update?
So we actually got a Renewing Democracy grant from Solutions Journalism Network, and that's going to be one of the stories for the new year that we're tackling, to see how voting was handled in North Dakota. A lot of tribes really took it upon themselves, and grassroots groups and Native organizations, as soon as this had happened. And to be clear, that there are tribes and Native voting advocates who work on these issues year round. It just happened to be a huge story that got picked up and, you know, went across the country and mainstream media as well. But tribes in North Dakota, grassroots groups, voting advocates, Native organizations really jumped on top of this, and they got the word out to tribal members across the state. A lot of and a variety of days, definitely using social media as a tool, and really educating people on what steps to take. And I think that helped in what we saw as, you know, people going out to the polls and voting and making sure they did have the proper IDs. So this is definitely a story that we're going to be updating in the new year, looking at what happened in North Dakota. Mm.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Mark. I want to spend a little bit of time before we get to Solutions Journalism about this. I don't even want to call it a debate about the wall. The thing that I think is missing from this conversation, and we've done a lot of shows about this, is that the United States spends billions of dollars on militarizing the border. NBC actually had a good piece called "The U.S. Already Spends Billions on the Border." And it found that, I just want to find the right numbers here. Over the past 24 years, the amount of money spent on the border has increased 14 times. The number of border patrol agents have increased 500%. The amount of border wall has grown from 77 miles to 700 miles since 2000. I mean, this really took off after 9/11. Funding for the border jumped from $1 billion in 2000 to $1.5 billion in 2003, and 2015, almost $4 billion. So this also exploded under Obama. What are your thoughts on this, Zenobia? I just keep waiting for this to also be part of the conversation, that the border is already so militarized.
Right. And so the stories that we continue to focus on are the solutions. I think what this has done on Trump, and how aggressive he's being about getting the wall to the point of shutting down the government, is kind of forcing Solutions Journalism to the forefront, because we are starting to see what people have been doing already locally. Mm. And so that's kind of what we've been focused on, like strong local initiatives and local leadership and what folks have already been doing, while also bringing out the fact that that the wall is already militarized and that so much funding has already gone to that. And so I think this is why it's so important to have Solutions Journalism right now, and the work that we've been doing is to bring that to the forefront. And to say that while we do depend on federal government and a lot of our resources come from that, that we still have to lean and depend on ourselves locally. And so those are the kind of stories that we focus on, that while that is happening, it's not an either or fight. It's a both and. We have to focus and pay attention on those things as well, so that we can systemically change that. But then we also have to focus on what folks are doing locally, and have been doing prior to this wall,
right,
prior to the funding of the wall, prior to the militarization of the wall. I mean, because what this is doing now is just bringing to the forefront for some people. You know, a lot of folks have already been impacted by the militarization of of our police forces and the wall as well, you know. So this is just making it so that more people know, which is a good thing, because then we have a stronger local front to come together and organize.
And Zenobia, tell us about some of the more solutions-oriented stories Yes Magazine is running about the wall and migration.
Right. So a lot of the stories that we've been focusing on was what was happening. For instance, we had a piece that ran about how people were helping migrant children, how they were helping refugees. Some of them were independent acts, but some of them were organizations that were coming together to volunteer and stand with the migrants that were coming in, and some immigrants. There are also in a lot of the cities, sanctuary cities, and Detroit is one of them. Although our local government will not really acknowledge the city as a sanctuary city, but the residents do, the people in the city do. And so you'll see in certain parts, for instance, in Detroit, where folks will have signs, you know, immigrants welcome here, or, you know, things like that. And so those are the stories that, you know, we've been focused on, is what people are doing at the local level to help.
You have a piece by Crystal Vance Guerra, Why Hondurans See Migration as an Act of Civil Disobedience. In walking out of their country en masse, Hondurans are making a loud, bold statement about the extreme injustices they face at home. And just a couple weeks ago, we did a show about what is really happening in Honduras, the United States backing the coup that happened there, which led to so much of the poverty and the violence that we see today. And then another colleague, Lucy Duncan, wrote a piece called I Walked Right Up to Militarized Police at the Border. Behind the agents, we could see our brothers and sisters watching from the Mexico side of the wall. We could hear them singing. What kind of reaction do you get from these pieces, which are, you know, very, very different from so much of what we see and hear in the national media?
I mean, it's hopeful, and it's a reminder to me of just what oppressed people have been doing, you know, for some time. And in that article, Crystal Van Guerra, she writes that, you know, oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. She quotes Dr. Martin Luther King, and some of the things that migrants are experiencing now are some of the things that African Americans have, you know, experienced over time in this country, and for sure some of the things that natives have experienced in this country. And so it's just, you know, another leg of that, another thing of that happening, and people rising up against it.
Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield is associate editor at Yes Magazine, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Antonia Gonzalez is anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage of Native American and Indigenous communities. Today, it's our media roundtable, and if you'd like to join us, we are talking about solutions journalism and what that really means. What if the media spent more time focused on what actually works, you know, looking at how we got here, looking at policies that got us here, and then talking about what it will take to get out of so many of the crises that we are faced with today. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. There's the Solutions Journalism Network, and in a recent article on their website, it says, the stories below all cover responses, not ideas and rhetoric, but real ground-level action to alleviate a clearly identified problem. We like to say that journalists who add a solutions-oriented lens to their reporting are not only watchdogs, but also guide dogs. Antonia, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, when we ended the year, you know, we talk about these issues every day on this show, and we said, let's just spend the whole month really talking about solutions, because there's people on the ground who are just doing work day in and day out fighting for these solutions, and it's just so important to highlight them.
Yeah, so we, it's easy to ask people to make a list of all the problems and issues facing their communities and their tribes, and then you ask people, what are the solutions or what's being done, and looking at maybe something that's going on here in New Mexico that a New Mexico tribe is doing. Maybe that's something that is working for them, and maybe it's something that can work for a community in the Plains. So I think that's part of solutions journalism reporting that we've been doing, and it's not, you know, it's not, we're not saying that this is the one-all answer to solve all the problems, but just taking a look at what communities are doing, what's working for them, and looking at that. I think one of the things that's great about doing solutions stories is we often see in mainstream media and other stories across the country all these problems. We know there are problems in Indian country, and we don't want to do another diabetes story, another, you know, gloom and doom story of all these issues that we already know are there. Of course, we're going to mention these problems, maybe some statistics, but really what is going on to address these problems and what's working for a community. For example, one of the stories we did in 2018 was looking at state of change and looking at what communities in rural areas are to address the digital divide. And there are native communities across the country that, you know, are working on bringing technology to their communities. And there was a group of Pueblos here in New Mexico that joined together and went after a federal grant to bring high-speed internet to their tribal libraries. Because oftentimes in native communities, the internet is so important for healthcare, education, jobs, and so looking at how this group of tribes in New Mexico did this, they really got a response from other tribes across the country where they wanted to do similar things. So I think that's part of solutions reporting, not looking at what are the solutions to the problems we're talking about today.
Right. And Antonia, as you were talking, I was just thinking about how things have really changed, in some ways gotten better after Standing Rock, because that got so much international attention. And I think I'm hoping it made the editors and the decision makers really think about diversity in the newsroom and what that means. Because, if you still look at the numbers, the decision makers are mostly still white men. But you are seeing and hearing from more Native journalists or people telling Native stories that are not the same story that we've been hearing for decades. You've got so many new books coming out by Native authors. Here in California, there's new scholarship about Native genocide, which is really important because a lot of people just don't know their own history. So can you talk a little bit about the changes that we've seen just over the last 2 years? A lot of it is really due to what happened at Standing Rock.
I hope so. I think that I'm a huge advocate for more Native Americans getting into careers in journalism, especially broadcasting, since we are broadcasters. But I think that it's also collaborating that is also making a difference. I think if people are collaborating with tribal media, it can really help and boost their coverage. We've done collaborations with, I'm a correspondent for New Mexico PBS, so we've done some collaboration with New Mexico In Focus, one of their programs. We've collaborated with High Country News, and also doing some collaboration through the Solutions Journalism Network. And I think it benefits both the tribal media like us and the non-tribal media as well, and broadening, whether it's the readership or people listening to our stories on the radio or seeing them on TV. I think it really is helping, and I think that yes, there's still a lot of work to do, but we also need more Native people in these management roles as well. And I think that will help, when it comes to Native stories. And I think the Native American Journalists Association has really stepped up the last few years. I'm a longtime member of that, and I think that you're seeing a lot more with their outreach to media organizations across the country about coverage of Native American issues.
Zenobia, one of the pieces in the latest issue of Yes Magazine is called Standing Rock's Surprising Legacy, A Push for Public Banks. And your colleague Deanna Anderson writes that in February of last year, 2017, Seattle became the first city to pass legislation to divest from a financial institution because of its role in funding the Dakota Access Pipeline. Yes Magazine has done excellent reporting on Standing Rock and highlighting specifically Indigenous women activists.
Yes, they have. They've done a great job, and we've had a lot of our readers responding, and you know, and how do they help? You know, what can they do? And a lot of them stepped up on the divest campaign and movement, and it was successful, and that's the work that we look to continue to do. The same with the stories that we did for Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives. Just putting these stories out there, a lot of the stories that had gone on in the past about mainstream stories in particular on African Americans, you know, have been the derogatory, you know, lazy, can't do for themselves. But when you really look at these stories and you go into the communities, you'll see that a lot of the same problems that Native country has, those same problems with education, with housing, with food, are also the digital divide are also in Black communities. And you'll go in and you'll see that in those communities, particularly in Detroit where I am, that you see that people at the grassroots level are, you know, are organizing to bring solutions to those. For instance, there was a community that came together to provide internet service, affordable internet service. There's an organization here that's helping people with renewable energy. And so, you know, those are the stories that Yes covers, and our readers, you know, love those stories because it gives them hope and inspiration for those who are going through some of the same things, but then those who are in positions to help. It also, because that's a question that, you know, we get a lot of times too, is like, what can I do?
Right.
You know, people feel so overwhelmed with the problems. What can I do? And so these stories give them hope that, you know, all is not lost and all is not going to hell, but there is something that I can do as an individual as well. And so a lot of our readers respond to that, you know, and they do. They seek out these organizations and they, you know, on their own to see, you know, what they can do to help.
Zenobia, since you are in Detroit, Michigan, can you give us a brief update on what's happening in Flint and drinking water?
I cannot.
Oh, you can't? Okay.
I cannot.
I thought you wrote about that recently.
About Flint?
Yeah, about Flint. And maybe I got the... Did I get the wrong name? I'm sorry about that. We were reading this morning about Little Miss Flint, Mary Copany, who is this young this young girl who is still handing out bottled water.
Yes.
And it's just kind of shocking that that's still happening. I mean, that needs to, that needs to be a story that we cover, you know, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the Flint story... It's just traumatic. The publication I was at before, yes, we covered that the water was poisonous, right? We covered that way before it hit mainstream media, and we talked about it. The GM plant there, they had switched their water reserve. They were bringing in water for them, and then there was a PR campaign to say, you know, hey, this drinking water is safe with glasses, you know, with the glasses of water that they didn't drink from, you know, or if they did, it was clean water. And so, but the water still wasn't safe. And then we found that out, you know, and Rachel Maddow did a great job of coming in and helping bring that story to the forefront, to mainstream media. Although we did have local, the ACLU had an investigative reporter, Kurt Guyette, who really, you know, helped bring that story to fruition about Flint. And so today, Flint still does not have clean water. So
wow.
That's about as much of an update that I can give
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I have 15 articles on my desk, and I think I missed.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, but thank you for
that's
the update.
Okay. I just don't like to speak without having a bunch of information, but I do know that they still don't have clean drinking water.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I wish more people did that. But we will definitely do, I mean, this is just tragic. We'll definitely do a show about Flint soon. Let's take one more caller before we end today. Let's go to Arion in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show. Oh, hold on just a minute.
I just put our money.
Hi, sorry about that.
Hi,
go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think we need to understand that the prison corporations along the border put pressure on their local politicians to make sure that they continue to build and fill the concentration camps along the border. We have to understand, if we want engaged democracy, that we have to learn how to invest and sacrifice our time and money in a way that lobbyists don't have to. They're paid, they're bankrolled, and they have tremendous access to the politicians in the local areas where they donate. And it comes to the time that we as Americans need to organize and understand that where we put our money reveals a lot about our values. And our military is threatening all life, not only in this nation and in the reservation and in California, where we're all in some ways Mexican Americans because this land was once Mexican, but around the world. So it's time to learn how to work without being paid.
Well, thank you for that. You just reminded me there was a very lengthy piece in the Times in June called The Billion-Dollar Business of Operating Shelters for Migrant Children. I'll just read the lead here by Manny Fernandez and Katie Benner. The business of housing, transporting, and watching over migrant children detained along the southwest border is not a multi-million-dollar business. It's a billion-dollar business. The nonprofit Southwest Key Programs has won at least $955 million in federal contracts since 2015 to run shelters and provide other services to immigrant children in federal custody. We did a show about this recently where we followed the money. There's another group called BCFS. They've received $179 million in federal contracts since 2015 under the so-called Unaccompanied Children Program. I mean, it's so important just to continue following the money on this. So we will definitely continue to do that. Thank you so much, Ariane. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rose, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and we're almost out of time.
No, I realize that. Yeah, if you look at the government shutdown, the two departments that are shut down that disturb me the most are the EPA and food inspections. And so when you start looking at poisoning America fast, this is the way to do it. So you remember how the cell phones have really changed the world by exposing police abuse and strange things happening. Well, there's a lot of environmental dumping right now, midnight dumping. And if people got out there with their cell phones and caught the polluters in the act, we'd be able to save ourselves cancer clusters in the future.
Well, this has been going on under all administrations and under this one especially. Eric Lipton of the Times just tweeted, as of Thursday, DOD will be run by a former senior Boeing executive. EPA is run by a former coal lobbyist. HHS is run by a former pharmaceutical lobbyist. And Interior will be run by a former oil industry lobbyist. Welcome to 2019. I mean, this is why investigative journalism is so incredibly crucial, and why solutions-oriented journalism is crucial. Thank you for that, David. We've done a lot of shows about what is happening with chemicals and, as you said, waste being spilled into the waterways and how that is affecting our health, and we'll continue to cover that this year. We have just about 2 minutes left. I'd love to ask both of you what you're planning to cover this year. Antonia, what are you all working on right now at National Native News?
So we'll definitely continue to cover the new Congress and follow the shutdown. And like I said, we have this Renewing Democracy project coming up, and we'll be looking at voting in North Dakota, and we're really excited about that.
And what about you, Zenobia? What are you planning to cover, and what are you covering more broadly at YES?
So, of course, we'll continue to cover the immigration issues and what's happening there, what's happening with the wall. I am working now on a storytelling piece about black mothers, and also a piece on Black Lives Matter Louisville and how they're helping low-income people there secure housing.
Well, that sounds, those sound like great stories. Any final thoughts, Zenobia, just on the importance of solutions-oriented journalism, since YES Magazine specifically focuses on that kind of journalism?
Yeah, I think that's what all journalism should be, right? I mean, you have your basics, your who, what, when, where, why. And what we do is look at the how, the impact, and then what people are doing. And that's what we're going, you know, to continue to do, you know, how people are responding to, you know, what's happening to them in their communities. And we'll continue to cover that, what they're doing, how they're organizing, so that others can also, you know, be inspired, learn how to think differently about what's happening right now.
Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield is associate editor at YES Magazine, a nonprofit independent publisher of sustainable journalism. Zenobia covers racial justice. Zenobia, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Antonia Gonzalez is anchor and producer of National Native News, an outlet that provides listeners with coverage on Native American and Indigenous communities. She's also a correspondent for New Mexico PBS. Antonia, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year. And I just want to highlight a couple of pieces over at the Solutions Journalism Network, the Marshall Project, how one county became a lab for California's prison reform, The Guardian, Inclusion Health, an Irish answer to the homelessness crisis, YES Magazine, this radical plan to fund the Green New Deal just might work. And there's so many other stories like that that really look at how we got to where we are today and how we can get out. Thanks to Zenobia Jeffries-Warfield and Antonia Gonzalez. Thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. If you'd like to listen to past shows, you can head over to yourcallradio.org. Thank you for listening. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.